Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be your host for this episode. But first, some exciting news. We've just released our call for papers for the 2026 Salt Lake Summer Symposium, which will be July 30th through August 1st at the University of Utah, so put it on your calendar. And this year, our theme is Artifacts and Art of Futures. And the call goes like this. What kind of art have people made from Mormonism, both with their hands and with their minds? From temple aprons to resin grapes, from hymns to hip-hop, from road shows to TikToks, from theology to science fiction, this symposium will focus on the things that have been made from Mormonism. From Corianton, the story of unholy love, to Heretic in the cinemas, from Nephi Anderson's novel Added Upon to whatever Brandon Sanderson's new novel is, from WKRP to Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, from recipe cards to tarot cards, from paper books to phone apps, and what will we make in the future, especially with the advent of AI? Who are some surprising Mormon and post-Mormon innovators in both the sciences and the humanities? And where are the surprising places that Mormon and post-Mormon fingerprints can be found? All LDS-related session submissions, whether theme appropriate or not, are encouraged. So, does that spark any ideas in your brain? I was thinking about doing a session on the differences in the pictures from the old Book of Mormon reader to the new Book of Mormon stories. You know, that comic book that the church produced about the Book of Mormon that you read over and over again in sacrament meeting when you were little because it was the only thing that slightly kept your attention. Well, there are a lot of differences, and I think that they reveal some really interesting things about how Mormon culture shifted from the 80s to the 90s. So for more information, go to sunstone.org/calls-for-papers. Now, one interesting fact about people who leave Mormonism is that most of them also tend to leave religion completely, like everything associated with religion, including God and the supernatural. I've heard it explained that Mormonism ties everything together so tightly that if one thing goes down, everything goes. And in my job, I talk with a lot of post-Mormons, and it does seem that most of them have finished with religion. They're not at all interested in seeing if there happens to be a better one out there. Religion feels to them like just a time and energy suck. They are done with God, and they're done with church. And I'll admit that something kind of similar happened to me when I went through my faith transition, which I'll admit is an ongoing process, 25 years and counting. The existence of God became a huge question for me, and it was one that I didn't feel like I had the ability to answer. I didn't know what kind of criteria I would use. I mean, what do I even mean when I say God? So most of the time, for me, it's felt like God, in the Mormon sense, is less likely, and sometimes completely unlikely. Though I'll admit that there's a piece of me, way down at the bottom of my psyche, that thinks there is a Mormon-type God, and is terrified about it. Enter an odd book I saw on the Kindle Daily Deal, titled Believe: Why Everyone Should Be Religious, by Ross Douthat. Now, Ross is a religion columnist for the New York Times, so obviously a smart guy, since they don't let just any old schlub write for them. And the basic purpose of his book, as mentioned in the title, is to persuade people that it is reasonable to believe in God and the supernatural, and that participating in church is a good thing to do. Quite a goal. And he knows it. Quote, "Isn't it just too difficult to be a thoughtful, serious, modern person and embrace religious faith?" he asks. And I might add, especially if you have exited a high-demand religion like Mormonism. But Douthat makes a few arguments at the beginning of his book about why one should give belief another chance. Quote, "Looking at the forces, populism on the right, wokeness on the left, that had taken over Western life as traditional religion fell away, a number of writers, including even some new atheist fellow travelers, acknowledged the naivete of the idea that simply removing Christianity or Islam from the stage would inevitably lead to greater enlightenment and peace. There is more fear that a post-Christian or post-religious future might yield not liberal optimism and leaping scientific progress, but tribalism, superstition, and despair. And then he quotes Atlantic writer Derek Thompson, saying, quote, "Maybe religion, for all its faults, works a bit like a retaining wall to hold back the destabilizing pressure of American hyper-individualism. Maybe we've discarded an old and proven source of ritual at a time when we most need it," unquote. So, Douthat is happy to admit that there are lots of sociological benefits to being part of a religious community. But he pushes it one step further by saying, quote, "Those benefits accrue precisely because religious perspectives are closer to the truth about existence than purely secular worldviews," unquote. So, yes, dear listeners, Douthat's goal is to make belief in God and the supernatural rational, and to persuade us that aligning ourselves with a religion is an entirely reasonable thing to do. I was intrigued, so I read it, and I had a strange reaction to it. I felt at once drawn by his arguments, but also resistant to accepting them. Why was that, I wondered. And in the end, he sent a ball into left field that I totally wasn't expecting, and it took up my thoughts for weeks. So, how does one go about persuading people who read the New York Times that belief in God is reasonable? Well, Douthat starts with the fact that the universe is rather extraordinary. As he writes, quote, "Our expanding horizon of knowledge has consistently revealed a system that's precisely balanced, exquisitely poised, in the alignments necessary to generate our specific kind of biological life," unquote. And as an example, he says, quote, "The cosmological constant, which governs the speed at which our universe expands, sits in a range that has roughly a 1 in 10 to the 120th power chance of occurring randomly. Now, that range is essential to prevent both a flying apart and a swift collapse, both of which would have doomed the development of anything like life. Or again, were the nuclear force, the force that binds protons and neutrons inside atoms, just fractionally stronger, a fraction that can be represented by the equivalent of moving less than 1 inch on a ruler the size of the universe itself, it would have eliminated all of the hydrogen atoms in the very earliest phase of the universe. No hydrogen, no water. No water, no us." So he says that these extraordinary coincidences are not coincidences at all. Rather, they were brought about by design. Sadly, I'm not an astrophysicist, so I can't tell you whether his numbers are accurate or not, but let's just say that they are. This is where we run into a funny problem. Is the fact that our universe exists really special, like being designed by a higher intelligence special? Or is that just the way the universe is, and it just happened to be the right kind to spawn us to be amazed by how unlikely the universe is? It's tempting to say that the universe really is special, but we can trace that kind of thinking to all kinds of human evaluations. I mean, we all think our religion is the best. After all, Jesus designed it. That our high school football team is the best. After all, Jesus helped the quarterback run the winning touchdown. We're just naturally predisposed to think that our fill-in-the-blank is the best. But you got to admit, according to Douthat's numbers, this universe really is rather extraordinary. I don't know what kinds of reasoning you could use to decide whether it was designed this way or came about by chance. It almost seems like your decision would largely be based on what you assume about the nature of the universe. Godful? Or godless? And Douthat, of course, is writing to people who see the universe as godless, and he thinks that they've arrived at their assumption mainly through the way we tell the story of science, which is usually framed as scientists going about upsetting the dogmas of Christianity. I mean, think of Galileo and Darwin. So these advances aren't framed as times when we discovered a process that God used to create the universe, but times when we discovered the process that makes God redundant. So before science, we said, God did that. And after science, we say, this is how it works without God. Now here's something interesting. Despite being a Catholic himself, Douthat admits that science proceeding as if God doesn't exist has been really helpful. Quote, if you posit an angel stepping in to carry a planet through a particularly puzzling orbit, or postulate a miraculous intervention to explain some apparent gap in the fossil record, you are effectively stopping your investigations short. Time and again, pushing further has revealed some new discovery, some new material explanation, some new layer of order, unquote. But that new layer of order is precisely what intrigues Douthat. He points out that implicit in science is the assumption that the universe is orderly. No scientist starts their studies thinking that they're going to uncover chaos. Even when something like quantum physics erupts onto the scene, it turns out to be another type of order. So Douthat argues that, quote, a more natural intellectual resting place for a lot of working scientists would be some kind of deism or pantheism, an openness to a divine ordering joined to a doubtfulness about miracles and special revelation, unquote. And that can lead us to an interesting interpretation of religion. I mean, religion has been thrown under the scientific bus because its ideas about how the world works turned out to be myths. But when we say myth, we mean stories about what the world means, not how the world works. Even if religion does cast its stories that way. So, the astronomy before Galileo was meant mostly to tell humans about what humans mean, which is why it placed them at the center of the universe. Humans are important, he was saying. And the same with Darwin. Before him, religion said, and then God created man, meaning humans are important. Those myths were giving humans a context within which to take their lives seriously, to do something important. And they did, some of them, by observing the world more and more precisely, and eventually they encroached on the myth and started turning it into science. So the way we tell the science story makes religion look bad. Religion's myth being replaced with the hard facts of science. And this recurring story gives us a reason to reject religion entirely. But what if we thought of religion more the way Will Durant thought about philosophy? He wrote, quote, philosophy seems to stand still, perplexed, but only because she leaves the fruits of victory to her daughters, the sciences, and herself passes on, divinely discontent, to the uncertain and unexplored, unquote. In other words, what if religion, you know, the idea of God, is the first tool we have for exploration, which is eventually superseded by other tools? So, God continues to the next mystery. The basic thing Douthat is saying is, the universe is ordered. No matter how deep we go, we find order. And not only is it ordered, it's extraordinarily ordered. And he uses that as a foundation to build the next piece of his argument, namely that humans are extraordinary in the same way. His argument can basically be summed up as, we know what parts of the brain fire up when we see or think or perform actions, but we have no idea how consciousness works. As Douthat summarizes, quote, if reading an argument makes you angry, if reading a novel makes you sad, if reading a poem stirs a sudden childhood memory, there's no material account of how that happens, how the outward act generates the inner experience, unquote. In other words, consciousness is best described as something supernatural, but supernatural meaning it can't be reduced to its physical parts. So you can show how a car functions by how its various parts work together, but you can't show how the brain produces consciousness the same way. Now, is this just us not having all the information we need? You know, will some brain-based Galileo eventually come along and show us the facts of how consciousness arises with their version of a brain telescope? It's possible. But Douthat points out that we haven't made much progress in that direction. Consciousness is something that still seems supernatural. And in fact, that sense of consciousness as supernatural has shown up in our attempts to make AI conscious. Can we put together something complicated enough that consciousness will just emerge from it the same way it seems to emerge from our brains? We don't know how it will emerge. We just know that something has to be really, really complex, like a brain, for consciousness to emerge from it. And that's apparently one of the ways that researchers are going. What Douthat is arguing is that something beyond the physical is happening here, and that it's an integral part of how we are, how we perceive. Quote, "Whatever consciousness may be, soul or mind, dream or spell, it self-evidently has its own integrity, its own being, which is intertwined with physical reality, without being reducible to physical substances and their interactions. The soul may not be exactly as ancient religions imagine it, but under any conceivable paradigm, it will always be very much alive." Unquote. However, he does admit you can, quote, "acknowledge the anomaly without necessarily being drawn toward religious explanations, let alone religious duties," unquote. So, he kicks things up one more notch by asking, why, quote, "has the human mind been able to penetrate so deeply into the mysteries of the cosmos, rather than having its efforts closed off early on by the constraints inherent in being just an ambitious ape? Why should capacities that evolved because we needed to hunt gazelles and avoid predators also turn out to be capacities that enable us to understand the laws of physics and of chemistry, to achieve manned spaceflight, to split the atom, to condense all of human knowledge onto a tiny piece of silicone? It isn't merely that the universe appears improbably fine-tuned to enable our existence," he continues. "It's that our own consciousness seems improbably capable when it comes to discovering that fine-tuning, like a key fitted to a lock," unquote. In other words, Douthat uses our very success in science as evidence that something more is going on. Quote, "We have much better evidence for the proposition that the universe was made with human beings in mind, giving our extraordinary success in discovery and interpretation, than ancient or medieval peoples ever did," unquote. His next argument is a little more empirical, though he didn't provide any footnotes, which bugged me. I would have liked to read more deeply into his sources, but he says, quote, "The late 20th century decline of institutional religion in America has had no effect on the share of Americans who report supernatural experiences. Indeed, by some measures, those reports have notably increased," unquote. He says that 1/3 of Americans claim to have experienced or witnessed a miraculous healing. In other words, the world has not become disenchanted with the disappearance of religion. It is as enchanted as ever. The thing that's changed is that we have fewer lenses to interpret it through. He talks about the author Barbara Ehrenreich, who doesn't consider herself religious, but who wrote a book called Wild God about her early teenage experiences with mysticism. Quote, "Her experience is transformative without being a conversion story," Douthat writes. Quote, "This seems to be a common way enchantment operates under secular conditions. People have the same kinds of experiences they once had in a more religious age. The bolt from the blue keeps falling when you least expect it. But rather than having a conceptual framework in which the experience immediately makes sense, it becomes a mysterious signifier to be interpreted through a purely personal framework. Or, as in many such cases, not interpreted at all," unquote. So even though people are no longer looking for supernatural events, they still encounter them. And the difficulty, of course, is that these kinds of experiences are really hard to study under scientific conditions. You simply don't know when a spiritual experience will hit or how it will manifest. And having them be so slippery to science makes us understandably wary of them. But Douthat compares mystical experiences to the experience of falling in love. We know that there are contexts conducive to falling in love, one of the most traumatic being the singles ward. Quote, "But as you move from general patterns of attraction to the specifics of a particular pairing, from generic lust to actual romance, predictability and replicability diminishes and finally disappears. You are as much in the hands of Aphrodite as any religious seeker hoping for a brush with God," unquote. And many of us believe in falling in love, even though we can't replicate it in the lab. His final piece of this argument is something that we actually talked about on this podcast a year or so ago. How hyper-real people describe their near-death experiences. I mean, they often say that the experience is far more real than day-to-day life, and often they want to get back to it. So Douthat points out how strange it is that the brain would, quote, "generate some of its most intense and memorable experiences, hallucinations far more powerful, coherent, and seemingly realistic than those available to dreamers in the peak of physical health, in the incredibly narrow window between the brain going into irreversible crisis and life being fully extinguished," unquote. He's asking, where's the revolutionary advantage of that? And besides that, shouldn't a dying brain be more likely to simply descend into incoherence? Douthat reminds us of psychedelic explorer Aldous Huxley's, quote, "idea that the brain is a kind of valve or reducing agent, which limits the potential experiences and encounters available to our consciousness in order to enable us to live normally within material reality." If this were the case, you would expect that diminishing the brain's activity through prayer or meditation, changing its internal calibration, or going through a partial shutdown process, e.g. death, would be, in fact, a kind of mind-opening experience, unquote. In other words, Douthat feels that the brain shields more than it reveals, which means that there are realms of reality that only show up when it stops functioning normally, which means there is something more. So those are his basic arguments. Quote, "The appearances of order and design in the universe, the deep mystery of consciousness, the peculiarly privileged-seeming position of human beings in the cosmos, and the resilience of mystical experiences and seemingly supernatural happenings," unquote. And all of these, he says, should make us feel that something is going on. But what should we do with that suspicion? And here's where Douthat makes his case for religion. He says, people have been thinking about these mysteries for a long, long time. They've left writings and practices that have been refining and evolving for sometimes millennia. Now, you and I are influenced by the Mormon point of view, as well as the contemporary scientific point of view, so we tend to say, yeah, look at all those centuries of feeling around in the dark. But Douthat sees it differently. The mysteries religions are exploring are so deep, so multifaceted, so infinitely layered, that of course it takes millennia to explore them. We're not looking at good money being thrown after bad here. We're looking at a sustained project worked on by millions of minds. As the religious scholar Houston Smith said, quote, "Everybody recognizes that it takes about 5 years to get your head into thinking about relativity theory and quantum mechanics. It's just such a different world. But everybody assumes that the religious world is accessible to everyone. Now, I profoundly disagree with that," unquote. But here's the thing that caught me by surprise. Douthat argues that when you get introduced to this mystical layer of existence, you aren't just being introduced to angels, miracles, and inspiration. You're actually entering an environment that is every bit as dangerous as real life. In addition to angels, you know, there are demons, or to put it less colloquially, the energies and personages in this mystical world flow in many different directions and have motivations of their own. So having some kind of roadmap, some kind of guidebook, is as essential in the spiritual sphere as it is in any place that you're unfamiliar with. And then, he adds one more layer. Going into this realm doesn't necessarily mean that you're becoming a better person. Quote, "You don't have to believe in hostile or deceptive powers," he says. "You just have to believe in the human capacity to misinterpret, seek attention, and become addicted to certain experiences or certain powers that their visions seem to grant," unquote. And this was probably the thing that surprised me most about this book. Dowlett takes all this time to build a case for taking God and religious seriously, but then he says, "Now that you're here, be careful." It went against all my missionary training, right? You're supposed to persuade people of your position and get them to feel the Spirit and then throw them in the water by showing them how great it is to be part of your religion. All the spiritual and social perks, the nice people, the inspired leadership, the spiritual guidance, the mansion in the sky. But no. Dowlett actually spends a whole chapter warning you about the things that can go wrong in religions and how wary you need to be. So any excitement that I'd been feeling up to that point drained away as I realized that he wasn't saying, "Believe and you'll be saved." Instead, he seemed to be saying, "Believe," and suddenly things get way more complicated. Because now, you have to deal with an entirely new invisible world, as well as a whole boatload of religions to dig through. And he has some interesting advice when considering what religion you might want to join. You can basically boil it down to size matters. Quote, "You should start the way you would in any other area," he says, "by looking for wisdom in crowded places, in collective insights rather than just individual ones. You don't need to engage with every single person who has ever claimed divinity or read every single putatively holy text. Instead, you can assume that the wisdom of the human past and the workings of providence have elevated a smaller set of figures and texts for a reason, and try to encounter several of them seriously," unquote. And he says that, you know, you'll be drawn to something that's good for you, either now or in the long term. And he cites a few stories of people who went on journeys through various religions and spiritual practices. However, he does make a case for finally committing, especially, oddly enough, if it's to a larger religion. Quote, "The big and important religions tend to harbor real diversity," he says, offering a sense that one can join a faith without settling every spiritual question immediately, and that one can change important views without departing, unquote. And that's an interesting point, because, you know, Mormonism, being a smaller religion and very certain of its correctness, doesn't offer that kind of latitude. Most of the people I know who have left the church did so because the church taught them that they did have to settle every spiritual question immediately, and that they can't change important views without departing. But I can see a few reasons why Dowlett would argue that committing to a belief system can be useful. I mean, it really does give you a lot more to work with if you have access to hundreds or thousands of years worth of thought. You get to stand on the shoulders of a lot more giants. Or maybe being part of a religion is like being in a structure whose purpose is to test an idea deeply. Or maybe religion is a person tester. How do one's ideas, hopes, and personality interact with this structure? Do you dig deeper into those aspects of yourself if you have a religious structure? I know that, again, in Mormon thought, the idea is that God sent his revelation through Jesus and the primitive church, and then it all got obscured by 2 millennia of Christianity, right? But do you get further and further from an original truth when you explore it and iterate on it? Or do you help develop a larger understanding of it? Perhaps one of the useful things about believing in a religion all your life is that you get to explore one metaphor of reality for an extended period. There are certainly lots of constructive religious metaphors that we could benefit from. But if a scholar can constructively spend her entire life exploring, say, Shakespeare or Virginia Woolf, why not a particular religion? Maybe you're, like, deep sea exploring, finding the very strange creatures that lurk in the depths. But the point isn't to find the right metaphor. The point is to plumb the possibilities of one. But despite this ecumenicism, Dalvet seems to feel that one religious tradition may have a better grasp on the truth than another, though he does think that following any of them will be constructive. And, being a Catholic, he thinks that Christianity is the one closest to the truth and spends a chapter telling you why. So as I was reading through all this, I remembered my friend Boyd Peterson's idea that religions aren't best described by how closely they hew to the truth, but by what their mission is in the larger religious world. And he argues that one of Mormonism's main missions is the development of temple worship. And that strikes me as perhaps a more useful approach to choosing a religion, or choosing one's place in a religion. Which religion's mission are you drawn to most? And once you're inside it, what is your mission within the organization? And how might that mission change as you change? For example, as you know, I've been drawn to a Unitarian Universalist congregation in addition to my LDS ward, largely because of its mission, which is basically to love people the way they are. I mean, when they took in my transgender kid joyfully instead of hemming and hawing like my LDS ward did, I knew these people had something special. Not necessarily religious truth, but a way of being that is much needed in this world. And I've seen that same thing draw in other people. I mean, when I first started going about 10 years ago, the chapel was about half full most of the time. It was always easy to find a seat if you came in late. But that's not the case anymore. The chapel is always full for Sunday services, and we're all turning into Mormons and setting up folding chairs in the back. And that attraction happens not because we say we have the truth, but because we have a definite mission. However, Dalvet doesn't talk about Unitarian Universalism in his book, and at one point he even disparages the idea of Universalism, meaning universal salvation. And he mentions Mormonism only in passing, once when he mentions the Book of Mormon musical, so I don't know if Dalvet would think either of my religious traditions have much theological traction, especially since, at the beginning of every UU Sunday meeting, the person at the pulpit tells the congregation that everyone is welcome here, quote, whether you believe in God all of the time, some of the time, or none of the time, unquote. But approaching Dalvet's idea generally, it seems that to him the most important thing is that you join one of these conversations, one of these missions, and that you use your particular talents and leanings to make the conversation a robust one, to continue the exploration, to make the tradition richer, or stabler, or more practical, or more mystical, you know, according to your genius. Essentially, Dalvet is suggesting that we find a structure for our love. But the interesting thing about all this is that Dalvet is writing to people who have never been believers, right? He's offering them a possibility that they haven't considered before, trying out God and religion. I mean, he cajoles them gently with things like, quote, God will repay even the most mediocre effort, the halting attempt to reach upward to the truth, the good faith attempt to understand our purposes that doesn't necessarily reach the mark, unquote. And that sounds rather quaint to people who are used to their leaders asking if you believe enough, if you do enough, if you would sacrifice like the pioneers, if you would be willing like Abraham to sacrifice your own child for the faith. Is this the kind of place that Dalvet is hoping his readers might eventually end up? I honestly can't tell from the book. It seems to be just doing one thing, luring the reader to take one step into belief. And it made me think about how belief has shaped me, and likely many of you, because we know exactly what it's like to believe. We probably spent years of our lives living in exactly the space Douthat is talking about, right? Believing in the reality of God and practicing religion. And then we had a faith crisis. And a lot of us feel that we came out the other side of belief. And Douthat actually acknowledges that this can be an important part of a spiritual journey. Quote, "Sometimes you have to purge yourself of an ungodly religious experience before you can begin anything again. For some people, perhaps, that purgation is itself the admirable spiritual effort, the investment of the talents, the movement that carries them toward alignment with the truth." Unquote. So, I guess if you've done that, good for you. But if, as Douthat says, God repays even the most mediocre effort, what does that mean about our believing time? I can certainly point to the sociological benefits that Douthat talks about, you know, community, a sense of purpose, a moral compass. But was there something more? And now that we've become, I suppose, nuanced or unbelievers, have we lost something? It reminds me of two speeches given at Sunstone in 2003 on the 10-year anniversary of the September 6. So one was by D. Michael Quinn. He said, quote, "I'm too selfish to motivate myself to follow the secular example of Albert Schweitzer and countless others who have not needed a church to make them follow the second great commandment. Religious fellowship and compassionate service have ended for me as an excommunicated Mormon, and that has been a profound loss. Whatever benefit to others may reside in the books and articles I've published during the past 10 years, I do not deceive myself into thinking that academic contributions can substitute for giving care to the sick, the dying, the impoverished, the orphaned, the widowed, and others needing human compassion." Unquote. And I admit that I too am largely motivated to give service through a religious organization, whether UU or LDS. And then he talks about his relationship with the divine, quote, "I do not have the same interactive engagement with God as I did when I was a missionary, a branch president, an elders' quorum president, a temple ordinance worker, a gospel doctrine teacher, a counselor in two bishoprics, or a member of a stake high council. However, I still feel the burning of the Spirit within me from time to time. I still talk with God as my Heavenly Father, give thanks for His many blessings, seek His guidance, and ask His intervention for myself and others." Unquote. The other speech was from Lynn Whitesides. She said about when she left the church, quote, "About this time, two things happened. I found an incredible therapist, and I began doing Native American ceremonies. Both of these, I believe, are gifts from God. One was rational, the other non-rational." Unquote. And then, after talking about her experiences, she said, quote, "I have faith in the truth. I have faith that God is here. As often as I get lost, I find my way back to myself and to God. The path I'm on is extremely interesting, and I find myself grateful for every step. I'm grateful for the Mormon Church, and I am grateful that its leaders kicked me out. I thank God for my life." Unquote. It's interesting to me that both Quinn and Whitesides retained a connection with the divine after they left the church and seemed to get a lot out of it. Did you see that new Knives Out movie yet, Wake Up, Dead Man? It has a young priest in it who has a conversation about religion with the detective, who's an atheist. And the young priest says, quote, "Do these stories convince us of a lie, or do they resonate with something deep inside us that is profoundly true?" Unquote. And maybe Douthat sees belief in the divine and the commitment of a religion to be the best way to resonate with something deep inside us that is profoundly true, especially for people who have never tried it before. But for those who have, as Douthat puts it, purged themselves of religion, the question seems to be very different. The main thing I kept chafing against as far as accepting Douthat's arguments is the domino theory that we heard in church. You know, that if the Book of Mormon is true, then Joseph Smith is a prophet. And if he's a prophet, then the church he established is God's church. So we feel that if we accept just one domino, all the rest will have to fall and we'll be stuck right back where we were. And this is the most intriguing thing about Douthat's book to me, that he seems to deliberately not tip over the dominoes. He doesn't tell you how great things will be if you start believing and practicing religion. He's telling you that though belief and religion are good ways to interact with reality, everything that comes after belief is an endeavor, a quest without a certain goal. By believing, you're not leaving purgatory to enter heaven. You're leaving Eden and going into the lone and dreary world. And you remember how things went for Eve and Adam: work, sorrow, an uncertain ending. And even if you are entering heaven, who knows what you'll find there? In his book, Rational Mysticism, John Horgan tells of a Talmudic legend about, quote, four learned rabbis who are allowed to visit paradise. One rabbi dies outright, one goes mad, and one becomes a heretic. A single rabbi leaves heaven with a blissful, peaceful heart, his faith confirmed, unquote. You could interpret this as a tale of how the last rabbi was most righteous, but I think it may be talking more about the difficulties of encountering the spiritual world. Now, I think religion in America bears plenty of blame for people's reluctance to be a part of it. In an Atlantic article titled "The Misunderstood Reason Millions of Americans Stopped Going to Church," Jake Meador, a religious man himself, writes, "Too often religion has, quote, not been a community that through its preaching and living bears witness to another way to live," unquote. And that really struck me, because I realized that Mormonism is exactly that. It claims to provide another way to live, but what it really seems to be is Americanism, codified in religion. Mormonism specializes in making productive, motivated Americans. So going to church isn't a respite from America. It's not another way to live. It's a motivational seminar. When do we get to see religion showing us another way to live? Where, as Meador writes, quote, "it asks people to prioritize one another over our career, to prioritize prayer and time reading scripture over accomplishment," unquote. A third space where we work out our salvation rather than our side hustle. I think that aspect of religion showing us a different way to live is going to become more important as the next few years unfold. Just after the ICE shooting in Minnesota, at the UU service I went to, the pastor said, quote, "church is not theoretical anymore," unquote. She said, "it's not a social club that we go to because we enjoy it. It's an essential part of encountering what our world is becoming." Quote, "the only way to face tyranny is together," she said. "We can't do it alone," unquote. And I think she has a good point. The civil rights movement was propelled by the Southern Black Christian Church, showing people a different way to live. So Douthat's book can probably be best expressed by one sentence in its introduction. Quote, "it's the religious perspective that asks you to bear the full weight of being human," unquote. It's an interesting thought because I know of a lot of people who use religion to get out of bearing the full weight of being human. They say, "oh, don't worry about that. God will take care of it." Or, "my religion already told me what to think on that subject, so I'm not going to waste any time thinking about it." But on the whole, I get what he's saying. Quote, "without eternal possibilities," he writes, "the stakes of every human life are lowered," unquote. And it's a good point. I mean, you can accomplish a lot more with a character in a novel than you can in a short story. If we see this life as a place where we start storylines or character arcs that will play out over eons rather than mere years, we will do a lot more thinking about who we're becoming and how we influence the world. The people we most admire in history are, after all, those who started storylines that they would only see the beginnings of. I guess what I got out of this book is the question, what asks me to bear the full weight of being human? It's a big question. It's one that can't be answered easily or in a short period of time. It's one that asks me to expand my assumptions and values, to seek wisdom from many sources. And it's one that I'll have to work out with other humans. One that will constantly remind me that life is bigger than I think it is. Well, thanks for joining me on that little jaunt. Sometimes it surprises me what kind of books spark an episode. Often they're books that are, you know, outside my usual line of thought and belief. Instead of being interested in them because they build on things I already believe or show me further extensions of my belief, I'm interested in them because they show me a different way of thinking, and this was one of those books. And speaking of thinking, remember to think about a presentation that you could submit to this year's symposium. It would be great to hear from you. Visit sunstone.org for our call for papers, and I will talk with you again next time.